So I don't know about y'all, but I've been walking even more than usual during this pandemic summer. And it sounds like Eric has too. In fact, on today's podcast, we learned that Eric might be that guy in the neighborhood with four dogs. And he takes us deep into the concept of walkability by discussing one of his favorite books, Walkable City by Jeff Speck. You'll learn that walkability is affected by so many components of our built environment, everything from speed limit signs to trees. It's easy to overlook the nuances of something that is so natural to who we are, but I hope today's discussion gives our listeners some new terms and ways to consider the value of walking and how we advocate for neighborhood designs that encourage this basic, simple act. If you don't have a chance to read all of Walkable City, Jeff Speck has some great TED Talks that highlight his work as well. We'll link to those in the show notes, so be sure to check them out.
Hey, everybody, you're listening to the Embedded Church Podcast, where we share stories about walkable churches creating new levels of belonging with their neighbors. I'm Eric Jacobson.
And I'm Sarah Joy Propay, and we'll be your hosts on today's episode of the Embedded Church Podcast. Hey, Eric, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you, Sarah Joy?
Good. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today because we get to talk specifically about Walkable City by Jeff Speck, one of the books that you chose for our reading list.
Yes. And I stand behind my choice as a
good
choice. Yes.
Glad to hear. Glad you're here. You're not waffling because I wouldn't know what to talk about otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in preparation for this podcast, do you know what I was doing before I sat down to record this with you?
You were walking your neighborhood?
I was walking the neighborhood. I was getting in the zone, preparing for this. And I have a question for you in regards to walking in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I was curious, what aspects of walking in your neighborhood do you enjoy most?
Ooh, good. Well, I'm going to answer that for my neighborhood where my church is located, which is less than a mile from where my home is located. But what I love about walking in the church neighborhood is I love to wave to and greet all the business owners and the workers because I know them all.
Nice.
And it's a very useful neighborhood. Like,
all right.
You know, there's a bank and there's a mechanic and there's a dry cleaners and it's a grocery store and you can get all your needs met. And it's just really fun when they say, hey, Eric, you know.
Yeah, they know you by name.
And you don't have to show ID at the bank and stuff. It's like, it's awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say for me, I mean, that's really great. I don't have all those relationships. I have some of those, but I like the fact that there's a lot of beautiful street trees in my neighborhood and there's a great diversity of houses. And so there's just so interesting to walk around. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I have walked the same path just numerous times. And every time I walk, I'm like, oh, I haven't noticed that nuance or that house. And so it's like a fun exploration every time. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I love that. Very cool. Are your street trees in full fall mode right now?
They are. They're absolutely amazing. It's like a snow globe of leaves that are all different colors. Well, Walkable City by Jeff Speck. That's what we're going to be talking about here. So just starting out with the big picture, talk to us a little bit. Why did you choose this book? Why is Walkable City worth reading?
Well, it's an important topic for one thing, and I'm sure we'll get into that here. But the other thing I want to say is it's just a really well-written book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of most of what Speck does. And one thing I really admire about him, and I have to kind of admit, as an author, I kind of die a little bit when I read Speck stuff because I just feel like he's so much better than I am as a writer. And he's not the most poetic or the most beautiful writer that I've read, but just his clarity.
Yeah.
Really clear and very persuasive. So it's his rhetorical style. And he uses personal stories and research. And he's kind of been on the ground in a lot of places, you know? So his, one of the indexes in the book is like a geographical index where you can look up different, he cites so many cities that he's been involved in either as a consultant or live there. And so it's really helpful in that way. And then lastly, he'll make a really convincing case for something like giving pedestrian extra accommodations in a particular area. But then just when you think he's going to go full on ideologue and say something kind of crazy, he'll pull back and say, well, you got to be careful not to take this too far.
Yeah.
And then he'll sort of pull it back to make it reasonable and convincing to someone who wouldn't necessarily be in his camp. It's a worthwhile book to read on that subject.
Right.
And it'll, if you're not a big fan of walkability. Reading this book will change your mind. I'm almost sure.
Yeah. Have you met people who are not fans of walkability?
Yeah, I think some people think it's, I think some people just misunderstand walkability. They think it's like anti-car or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, which that makes sense then. You know, you're talking about Jeff Speck's ability to not like beat you over the head with an idea, but to like have some sense of limitations that these ideas have, and we can't do everything to its fullest extent in our lives necessarily.
One example that you maybe think of on this topic was, you know, the one chapter where really gets into walking versus driving or whatnot. He starts with, maybe this isn't a good time to admit this, but I love cars.
You know,
I subscribe to Car and Driver and I can name every car. He went on and on. All of a sudden he's like, okay, this guy is not anti-car, right? And
then right.
You know, like why walkability is so important, you know,
right.
Why cars
can be a
problem.
And then he has a section about putting cars in their place, right?
Yeah,
so there is a place for cars, but what does that mean then? So we're going to dig into that. Very cool.
If you read this book and you're not convinced, you can send your receipt to us and Sarah Joy will refund your purchase price. Yes.
As soon as I get paid for this podcast, Eric.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Those things will have to kind of happen sequentially.
Right. All right. So you've talked a little bit about who Jeff Speck is, but can you tell us a bit more? Like, what's his history? Is he an urban planner, an architect? Where does he come from?
Sure. So I think his background is, I think he's got a degree in architectural history and architecture. So I believe he's a licensed architect, but I'm not entirely sure about that. Professionally, he served as like a town planner. He worked for Duane Platter-Zeiberg, DPZ, which is kind of a famous new urbanist firm. And then he had a long stint as a director of design at the National Endowment for the Arts. And then he ran something called an Institute on City Design for mayors. And so that's, you know, again, why he can cite so many concrete examples. And then I think since then, he's been writing and lecturing and doing consulting.
Okay.
So I think he's primarily like a town planning consultant that probably works for governments or private entities that want to do something cool that has to do with walkability.
Let's talk about walkability. Let's unpack that a little bit. That's
sure.
A term that we throw around a lot on this podcast. I think, in fact, our motto is walkable churches, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So what does that mean? And why is that such a big deal to Speck? Like, why does that merit writing an entire book?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of how his book is broken down. In the first part, he'll make the case for walkability. And then the second part, he talks about how do we achieve walkability. And it's a lot more complex than I think people probably think. We'll start with why walkability. And Speck kind of breaks it down into three major reasons. One is wealth. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, people now are starting to figure out that a lot of the promises made by suburban sprawl have not come to fruition. And so there's a strong desire for people to live in walkable communities, and they will pay for it. And so both, you know, individual investors, but also cities will find that get better tax revenues by investing in walkability, because that's where the money is. A lot of millennials and surveys will say they want to live in a walkable neighborhood, and we need to be paying attention to that. So wealth is the first kind of reason. Health, you know, obesity is a huge problem. And, you know, we think McDonald's is the culprit, or we think that people not going to the gym enough might be part of the problem. But Speck makes the case, and the CDC agrees with him, that cities are designed in such a way to either increase obesity or to increase healthful living by how much they allow and encourage walking as a natural part of everyday life, not as a separate kind of go and get some exercise kind of thing.
Right.
So
yeah, I heard once that somebody who takes public transit to work, so they're not necessarily walking the entire way into the office, but even if they're just taking the bus, that they actually achieve this recommended steps in a day far more than other people do, simply because they have to walk to the bus stop. And that, you know, it could be even just a 5-minute walk. But I think that shows like how much that, if we don't even have that built in, how little we walk.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We've built communities where walking is all but impossible as a transportation form. It's something we do, you know, for exercise. But
right.
So health includes obesity, high blood pressure, but also includes loneliness, which is kind of an important topic for me, that's a health factor. And walkable communities tend to be less lonely. His third big reason for walkability is sustainability, like environmental concerns. And he is one of many now that have pointed out that when you look at fossil fuel use or carbon footprint on a per capita basis, places like New York City score so much better than places like Vermont, you know, where you've got all these sort of people who recycle and drive Priuses around.
Yeah.
Because they have to drive. Even driving a Prius like 60 miles a day for your commute is going to be worse in the environment than the average New Yorker who's going to take the subway or walk and doesn't own a car.
I have a great story about something like that.
Yeah, tell me.
So I was at a dinner once here in the Twin Cities, and it was like a sustainable farmer dinner type thing. Yeah. And I sat next to this couple who were lamenting that they were looking for the last of the local apples in season.
Yeah.
And they drove all the way to Wisconsin to get these local apples. And I was like, you're all about sustainability, but you just drove like 40 miles to get local apples in your car.
Exactly.
Sometimes we don't put these things together.
Yeah, I think Spec makes a similar jab at one of these organizations that moved.
Oh, yeah.
They moved their organization, you know, out of the city to get a LEED certified building. And
it was the EPA.
Oh, it was the EPA? Oh, my gosh. No, you got to be kidding. And so all their employees now to drive like way further to get to work.
Right.
Way worse on the environment than whatever their building was emitting before the LEED standard one.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Those are some great reasons. I would be curious to hear from you as a pastor, what would be some theological reasons that you would maybe add to Jeff Speck's argument in regards to wealth, health, and sustainability?
Absolutely. So I would underscore theologically, at least the second two of the ones I just mentioned. I'm not sure if God necessarily cares if I make a lot of return on my investment or those kinds. So the health, the wealth thing, I'm just going to leave off the table for a moment. But of course, I do think God, as part of human flourishing, wants us to be healthy. In terms of sustainability, we're supposed to be stewards of the earth. And so not encouraging environments that are polluting and resource using is good. But I think just in general, walking is more basic humane activity for embodied creatures. You know, I think we were created with bodies for a reason. And we've got, as Christians, we have sort of some theological reasons for not just accepting, but celebrating the fact that we are embodied creatures and we are meant to interact sort of face-to-face in person. And so I think walking is a really good human activity. It's interesting. I just actually looked up this morning, the Greek word for walking in the New Testament is peripateo, and it's used a lot in the New Testament, like close to 100 times. And a lot of the times it's about walking, and we could talk about the fact that Jesus did a lot of his ministry walking around, but it's also used as a kind of word meaning to live. You know, so in Ephesians 4:1, it's like, live according to your calling, basically. But it's peripateo, like walk in this manner.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that's really interesting to consider that, not just meaning live your life, but really, you know, the boots on the ground kind of way that we go about stuff. And I think walking, there's a lot of really interesting implications for what it means to physically walk as an expression of our faith.
Definitely. I mean, I think it opens up so much more for relationship and using your senses and really engaging in the world. And like you said, with that embodiment that we've been given.
Yeah.
Also, I'd say for me, I love the fact that in Genesis, we have God walking in the garden with Adam and Eve, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know what word gets used there. Maybe you know. But that's such a beautiful picture to me of God actually coming alongside his children and being with us in that regard. And then again, you've talked about this, but like being called to walk humbly, that's a big part of our calling as Christians and believers here on earth. And too, I also like to think of the Good Samaritan. People, you know, always kind of extrapolate that story to be like, oh, well, you know, the Good Samaritan means anybody who's your neighbor. I'm like, yeah, but in the story there, it was literally the same walking path. Like,
yeah.
So let's not broaden it so much that we lose the specificity of the story as well. And what that means to actually care for those on our walking paths. So.
Yeah. And that, I think I may have already told this story in our first one, but the hemorrhaging woman is the other one that I love.
Oh, great.
You know, where she's walking and she encounters Jesus and touches the hem of his garment and gets this incredible transforming encounter with him. But that story would just not happen in a modern drivable culture. She would have to like make an appointment with Jesus and show up at his office. All these things that a sort of underserviced person isn't likely to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he's walking around makes him accessible to her. In my day-to-day ministry, so much of the choices I make about where to spend my time and energy and attention have to do with unexpected spontaneous encounters that only happen because I am walking around.
Yeah.
I do schedule my week and I do make appointments, but I have to leave room for the unplanned. And to me, that can happen a lot more naturally when I have walking as part of my daily routine.
Definitely. One thing that's evolved over the pandemic that's been really cool to hear for me is my parents have been walking very regularly at the neighborhood park. And through that rhythm, they have actually gotten to know several other people who are also walking the park every morning. I mean, it's grown to the point that a couple of weeks ago, I was like, oh, what are y'all doing today? And they're like, oh, well, we're going to sit in the backyard of this couple that we met just on the walking path at the neighborhood park. And so they're developing these new friendships right there in the neighborhood simply through this rhythm of walking that they've had over the pandemic. Yeah.
We have kind of a variation of that story. We have four dogs.
Yeah.
A lot of time they sit in our front yard. We've got a fenced in yard, but we've been walking every day as well. We take our dogs with us. And there's so many people who we run into who know our dogs because they're walking, you know, and they see our yard and they talk to our dogs and what they recognize our dogs and we start talking and we've made all these connections through dogs and walking.
What makes a place walkable? I mean, we talk about it and we talk about how great it is, but are there specific things that are needed to really make a place walkable?
Yeah, absolutely. So spec does two kind of things to help create the skeleton, I guess, around which this will all hang. And so the first level of things he calls the conditions of walkability, and that's under his, he calls this his general theory of walkability. And there's four conditions of walkability. One is useful. When you're talking about walkability, you really have to get people out of the mode of walking as a, like going to a special place to go walking is different from the useful walk where you actually walk to get your groceries or walk to visit your friend or walk to get coffee or something like that. So a useful walk is one of them. Safe. When you're out walking, you not only need to be safe, but you need to feel safe. And that has a lot to do with how wide the streets are, if there's any protection between where you're walking and where the automobiles are traveling quickly. And then comfortable, there's just a sort of a beautiful science of what, almost like from a visceral level, what makes us feel comfortable, a sense of enclosure.
Yeah.
Well, he talks about an outdoor hallway or an outdoor room.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, when you say a sense of enclosure, can you give a visual picture of what enclosure looks like for walkability?
Yeah.
Walkability?
So if you're walking down like a typical main street, even in a small town or something like that, you're going to have buildings on both sides of the street and you're going to get a sense of being sort of enclosed in a good way, not trapped, but kind of enclosed in. Compared to if you think about a national retail chain, so you've got Target on one side. This is the one that I have to go to sometimes. Target on one side and PetSmart on the other. And there's a big parking lot between them. As you walk from Target to PetSmart, in fact, you probably wouldn't want to walk.
Right.
You might even drive, even though it's like, you know, maybe a couple hundred yards, because it's so, you feel so exposed out there. There's nothing kind of holding you in. And so that's just kind of a quick picture of enclosure, but you really, you notice these things viscerally.
Right.
And you actually just sort of enjoy walking when the enclosure is done right. But until you learn to pay attention to it, you don't know why you feel comfortable in one and not comfortable in the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth condition is interesting, that it's got to be visually interesting. There's got to be variety. And things that kill interest are things like blank walls that aren't broken up with any kind of interesting storefronts and big parking lots sort of kill interest. So those are four conditions. And then from those, he'll get drill down the details with 10, what he calls steps of walkability, kind of double entendre for steps, but anyway, he's got 10 steps that kind of fit under those four conditions.
I don't think we're going to walk through all 10 with our listeners because that might be a bit much.
If only we could, though. They're really good. But yes, I agree. We probably can't.
We'll try not to make this podcast 2 hours long. So, but we've already touched on this first one a bit, but let's expand on that a bit more. Put cars in their place. That is like the first thing out of the gate that he says. Yeah. So let's unpack that a bit more. What does that mean?
Absolutely. So what Speck throws right out there from the very beginning is you really got to decide what you're going to prioritize. You can't kind of have both. If you're going to prioritize cars as the most, you know, everyone's going to be driving a car, that's going to make it really uncomfortable to be a pedestrian. And if you're going to encourage pedestrians, you can still have cars. And we can talk about that in a moment. It doesn't preclude cars. But the things that pedestrians need are very different from what cars need. And I think one of Speck's most important points he makes regarding cars is something called induced demand. And so listeners, write that down or go to our website. And in the key terms, you're going to find induced demand. But induced demand is a really important concept. So give me just 1 second to kind of lay this out. You would think that a traffic engineer, they're trying to predict what kind of capacity that we need for streets and parking spaces and all these kinds of things that are based on what users are going to need going forward based on growth of population or new stores coming in or those kinds of things. And so you predict what the need is going to be and you create the capacity for it. And what Speck points out rightly is that is not how it works at all. In fact, what happens is when the traffic engineers get to play a too powerful of a role, they will build capacity that will actually induce more demand. So if you build an extra lane of roadway, you're actually going to get more cars traveling on it and traffic is going to get worse over time.
Right.
If you build bigger parking lots, you're going to create more problems because no one's going to want to walk in those environments. And so we're constantly building environments that actually invite people to drive as opposed to inviting them to walk, and we create more hassles.
And what I've heard about like induced demand, so oftentimes, you know, you see in these cities, oh, we're going to expand the highway because congestion's just gotten out of control. We're at gridlock every time rush hour comes. And so if we add 2 more lanes to the highway, but what it doesn't account for is the fact that there's several people who are not driving because of the congestion. And so they don't want to put up with it. And they're finding ways to commute at like alternate times or taking alternate modes of transportation. But as soon as you add that extra lane, then people have this idea of suddenly there's more space on the highway. And so all those people who were not on the highway decide to get on the highway. And then you're at that same gridlock once again.
Right. Absolutely. So I know our listeners, some of them are going to be very skeptical about that, but that's been proven over and over again.
You add
lanes of freeway or highway or whatnot, and you're going to get more traffic. The other one that's the opposite of that, which is also counterintuitive, is skinny streets.
Yeah, talk about that.
Take a 4-lane arterial and then you cut it down to 3-lane arterial and you actually increase traffic flow.
Yeah.
And it has to do with like left turns and crazy stuff like that. And you actually, because you've eliminated a lane, you can do some really cool things about adding bike lanes or more pedestrian amenities, which will encourage less people to need to drive. But even the drivers, the same amount of cars going on that same roadway with less lanes, it can handle more capacity. So a lot of counterintuitive stuff in this chapter. But that's why I say, if you only read one chapter, that might be the one to read.
Yeah. And I think what's important to note is that, again, there's space for cars. It's not that necessarily we're advocating get rid of all streets and roads and make everything completely only walkable, right?
Exactly.
But it's doing it at the correct scale and in the correct locations. That's the important part. And one of the things that we were talking about a little bit before this interview was the difference between a street, a road, and then what Chuck Marone from Strong Towns has called a strode.
Yes, love that.
And this
sounds like a beer.
Right? Maybe that the strode brew. That's what we can come up with after this season.
Yeah.
But what that is really, you know, like streets are designed, there may be 2 lanes, one each way, much more neighborhood scale so that as a pedestrian, you feel safer, you're able to cross. Whereas roads are much larger scale. And that's really for like the transportation of like goods and between like cities and across the country and highways and things like that. But unfortunately, we've designed our cities where we have what Chuck calls strodes, which are kind of this like combination between a street and a road. And so it's at the size that it produces the same kind of volume and speed of traffic that is really more meant for like a road and a highway than a street, but it's put into our neighborhoods and places. So then it makes it very unsafe for pedestrians. We'll link to some Strong Towns information about strodes because I'm sure I didn't do it justice. But.
No, that's awesome. And so just to kind of summarize, streets are good.
Yes.
We want streets. They're an important part of our public realm and a lot of good things happen. There's so many misconceptions about streets. I don't know when that big campaign was, but let's help get our kids off the streets, you know.
Right.
We actually need kids on the streets.
He also talks about mixing the uses.
Yes.
And he particularly highlights housing in that component rather than it being
that was interesting.
Fully, you know, commercial and housing. And so would love to hear you unpack it a bit more and kind of what stood out to you. And I've got a couple of things that I think we should talk through with our listeners too.
No, absolutely. I'm glad you asked that. And that's good. You know, when I learned from the new urbanists about how important mixed use is and what zoning did, you know, when zoning was sort of dictated everything that we did was separated the uses, right? We put housing here, we put shopping here, we put worship there, we put recreation over here, and you had to drive between all those destinations. That's kind of the problem of post-war suburban America, is these separate uses. So mixed use is the counterpoint. We need to have a mix of uses within a walkable region. So you can walk to get your groceries, you can walk to a coffee shop. That's how I've typically used mixed use. And I think that's how it's typically understood. But what Speck does is really focus on housing, because I think he sees that as a key component to mixed use. If you don't get housing in all the right places, or you've got places that are excluded from any kind of housing, you're going to fail from the beginning. So he spends most of the chapter talking about why it's so important to get housing, especially housing in downtown, housing in places where you've got the commercial and other stuff set up. Yeah. What did you notice about that mixed use?
Yeah. So one of the things that he pointed out in that regard, because he said, you know, we are moving back into the city in so many ways. And so housing is making a comeback into downtowns. But then what we're running into now is that housing is so expensive that we're creating these monocultures, because there's so many of these more wealthy urban yuppies moving into town. And that could be a problem in that regard, because he says, you know, a diversity of people and a diversity of things going on actually is like really helpful, because there's the more that are different types of people use the city at different times of the day. And so a monoculture works against that in some ways. And so, and that can be detrimental to street life. And so he really pushed for a couple of things in terms of housing that would make it more inclusionary for a diverse socioeconomic group of people to be in the heart of downtown. And a couple of things that he talks about, which I think are good counterpoints to some of the things we talked about in the Happy City podcast. He talks about inclusionary zoning. So we had touched on exclusionary zoning,
right?
But he talks about inclusionary zoning, and that's really asking developers to make space in their developments for affordable housing. There's a lot of cities that have moved in that direction. And in terms of, you know, if a developer puts in a new housing development, they're required to maybe put 20% of their units are affordable at the local area median income. Or if they don't put in the affordable units, then they are required to pay a certain amount to opt out of that. And then that money goes into funding the city, funding affordable housing in other ways. Right. So that's one thing that he pushes for. Another thing that he talks about are granny flats or accessory dwelling units.
Oh, love it. Yes. Love ADUs.
Yeah. Yeah. And so do you want to tell our listeners what ADUs are?
So yeah, accessory dwelling units are kind of converting a backyard garage into a livable space. That's what mother-in-laws or granny flats, because you might have a family member living there, but they're wonderful rentable places. And it's, I think historically, that was one of the ways affordable housing happened organically.
Right.
And it's a really wonderful way to go about it, because it works for your own extended family. You know, if your kids get older and before they launch out, they can live there, or, you know, as parents get older, they can live there. But it's also a place that you can rent and get some rental income, which can allow you to afford your mortgage. And even some, I've seen some people do it the reverse way, where they will buy a house, you know, build an ADU on it. And when they're just a young couple before they have kids, they live in the ADU and rent out the actual house.
Yeah.
And they, as their family gets bigger, they start having kids, then they swap and they move into the house as they need more space. And it's a really great way to kind of ease into a housing market that might be a little beyond your reach.
Right. And I would really encourage our listeners. There's a lot of cities across the U.S. right now that are doing a lot of work around bringing ADUs into the zoning code. So historically, a lot of our zoning has precluded ADUs from being built. And now we're making the move back to bringing them back into our zoning codes and making them allowable. So if you're in a city that's considering that, definitely go to that table and voice support for that, because that's one of the best ways to have affordable housing in our cities.
I know one of the issues with that, and I think it's being addressed, but I know there's some concern with folks doing that and then making it like an Airbnb type rental.
Oh, right.
You have a lot of turnover. And that's that has a very, I mean, sometimes that's a useful way to use some property in your house or whatnot, but that sometimes has some negative effects that you don't want. And a lot of those new regulations are putting in conditions so that that doesn't happen.
Right, exactly.
Because it's a very different dynamic having a long-term renter as opposed to short-term rentals.
Right. And I think what's great too is it adds density. This is a way to bring density to some of those first ring suburbs and established neighborhoods, because the more density we have, the more that increases walkability. But some of these places are already pretty built out. So this is an easy way to increase density in some of those places.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's move on to the safe walk. There's a point within the safe walk framework that he talks about in terms of protecting the pedestrian.
Yes.
So let's unpack that one a bit more. What are some highlights for you?
Absolutely. I'll tell you a quick story on that one. My daughter is a grad student in public health, and she's doing maternal and child health, but she's taking a variety of classes right now. She sent me a link to this list of like the top 10 public health inventions that have helped, you know, improve public health. And I looked at it. One of them was the speed limit sign.
Oh, interesting.
And I said, I take issue on that one. I disagree, because I had just read a spec on this, and his spec's claim is that we engineer our roads for high speed travel, and then we think we're going to cause people to slow down by putting speed limit signs that are lower than what you could actually drive this thing at. You know, you got these really easy curves and wide streets and whatnot. So people are going to drive 45 miles an hour if it feels comfortable to drive 45 miles an hour, even if the speed limit says 30 miles an hour.
Right.
And going up to 45 miles an hour can be really dangerous for a pedestrian crash. There are much higher percentage of fatalities when you go above 40 miles an hour as opposed to the lower speeds. And so a lot of what Spec talks about is to really engineer roads in such a way that causes cars to slow down,
right?
Especially in walkable areas.
Can you give some examples of ways to engineer the road that way?
Yeah, I think to make them narrower, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to not do such generous curves.
That makes turning easy.
Yeah, exactly. So 90-degree turns. You can put various kinds of curb bump outs that just cause people to pay attention. But one of my favorite things, though, is to, and this is, again, counterintuitive, but it's to increase the chaos in some ways, the perceived chaos for the drivers.
Yeah, totally.
This whole cool thing on naked streets.
Yeah.
And so this idea, it's a city planner in Denmark, I believe, who's been doing these crazy experiments with naked streets, where he removes all the paint and all the signage. So there's no lane distinction. There's no stop sign in a city. And you would think it would just lead to major chaos and fatalities and crashes. And it has the opposite effect. It actually reduces crashes, because motorists realize they have to pay attention, because they don't have signs telling them everything. And when they're paying attention, they're noticing some of the unpredictable things like pedestrians and bicycles and whatnot. And so they end up, just driving a little slower, a little more carefully, and they don't crash into each other. So
interesting. So when I did placemaking work in Wisconsin a couple of years ago, one of the things that we did, there were several small towns that had main streets that were technically state highways. And so people would just fly down Main Street, and it was very unsafe. And so we did a couple of interventions where we put parklets. So, you know, these temporary kind of park type things, and take up one lane of traffic for just a short stint. And it was so fascinating, because they had the police come and track speeds before, during, and after the project.
Yeah.
And simply having just a small parklet, like little section there, it reduced the average speed by like 5 miles an hour. Because suddenly there was something that was new and different, and people would slow down. It's a little bit different because we didn't like remove all the things, but even adding something to the environment that was new and different and eye-catching, and we'd have balloons and streamers and stuff like that, it would cause people to slow down. So,
you know, I think he gives the example kind of in a little bit of a similar vein. I think it's Sweden switched. So their dramatic drop in automobile accidents and fatalities happened I forget what year it was. And the reason was they switched from driving on the left-hand side of the street to driving on the right-hand side of the street. That was the only change. And what it did, similar, it created this sense of like, oh, I'm not as comfortable with this. I don't know what I'm doing. And it lasted for a couple of years. And then people got used to it and started crashing again. But anyway.
Well, maybe we should just switch all our lanes of traffic.
That's what he said. He said, every 3 years, we should just switch.
Right.
But he actually didn't recommend that. But he was just making the point that not making it so easy for cars, but making it a little harder actually helps everyone be safer.
We're going to move on to the next point that he talks about in terms of the comfortable walk.
Yeah.
So he talks about shaping the spaces.
Yes.
Tell us, what does that mean?
I love that concept. In fact, shameless plug, my second book is called The Space Between. The reason I titled it that was this very idea that in the urban environment and the neighborhood kind of environment, buildings aren't meant to be seen like as a sculptural object that you just admire as a freestanding thing. But buildings primarily serve to shape the space between the buildings, because that's where we spend a lot of our time. We shape what we had talked about earlier, the outdoor rooms, the outdoor hallways. Yeah. And so buildings can do that well or not well, depending on a lot of things. But a big part of the problem is both parking requirements that we have in the suburban style of development. With massive parking requirements, we tend to push buildings towards the more figural object, whereas the Taco Bell in the middle of a big parking lot.
I was like, yeah, it's in the island in the parking lot.
Kind of thing, right. And some, you know, well-known architects kind of prefer that because everyone can see their building and it makes them look really amazing. But what spec really argues for is figural space, that these buildings really should shape the space and you shouldn't notice the individual buildings as much. When I look at the built environment, I see that. And I think that's a big paradigm shift for people to really see what's the quality of the urban space. And that's the thing that makes you feel comfortable. That's the thing that makes it pleasant to take a walk, is when that stuff is really well designed and organized.
Yeah. One of the things that he talks about in that section too is this idea of the missing tooth in our neighborhoods. And working in real estate development, we talk about that all the time. But the missing tooth is when, you know, you're walking down the street and you have this great semi-enclosure, this line of stores or whatever it is, and that safe, comfortable feeling that we're talking about. But then all of a sudden you come across like an empty lot, this blank space, and all of a sudden it feels like there's this missing tooth in the middle of the urban fabric.
Yeah. So, and it sucks. It sucks the life. You know, it's really, yeah. So I love that concept. He doesn't get into it too much here, but, you know, just the whole idea of fabric buildings and monumental buildings that, you know, in a lot of cities, you might have a building that really stands apart because it's this grand building and it's a public building and or a church or something like that. And it really is set off by all the liner buildings that sort of create the frame that you could see this other building in. So, you know, it's a really wonderful way to think about the city as a kind of this moving sculptural object rather than individual buildings.
Right. Well, I always think of it too, like as a puzzle. There's like all these pieces that are kind of fitting together and making this grand picture, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, as you move through it, you start to, different things open up, different vistas open up to you, and it makes it dramatic.
Right, right. Cool. All right. Well, within the comfortable walk, he also talks about planting trees.
Yes.
And I just want to tell our listeners that in Eric's notes on planting trees, the only thing it says is, obviously.
Yes, why not? Trees are awesome.
So, but why is it so obvious, Eric? Make it obvious to our listeners.
Well, there's almost all gain and no loss in some ways. It's they add shade, which is comfortable. They, you know, absorb CO2 emissions. They look nice and they're super easy to plant. I mean, I guess spec makes the realistic point that you got to make sure someone's going to water them too.
Right.
Sometimes cities get a little too happy planting trees everywhere, but they don't have a plan in place for people to water them. And that can be a problem. But it's certainly something that our listeners, especially if they're involved in churches, call low-hanging fruit, you know?
Yeah, plant
some
trees.
It's easy to plant trees in a neighborhood. And you really do increase the value of your neighborhood. You increase the, you know, all sorts of health metrics by just having trees. I think spec cites a study about, you know, what happens to our blood pressure when we're walking in an environment where there are street trees around versus ones that aren't. And it's just, we just feel better. So obvious.
I was also going to make note that there's a study that found that about an adjacent tree to a house added 3% in the median sale price of that house.
Yes.
And each tree is equated to about $20,000 in real estate value. It's pretty crazy, right?
That is crazy. Yes.
So,
isn't there a good quote in that chapter that our listeners might appreciate? I'm not going to say it because I'm more likely to be on the butt end of this joke in this camp. Enough said.
So this is my favorite quote in the whole book. I laughed out loud. It comes from like the Farmer's Almanac in 1885 or something like that. But it says, "A bald head is not comely, neither is a street seemly, which is not well set with trees." I apologize to all of our bald listeners, but that's what the Farmer's Almanac says.
Can't argue logic like that, for sure.
All right. Let's talk on this last point. So the interesting walk, there's one element that he says in particular. Well, he has a couple, but we're going to highlight one in particular. He says, make friendly and unique faces. What does that mean?
Yeah. So Speck, again, being sort of brilliant here, is willing to point out that this is one place where the mall had it figured out, you know, well in advance. So he makes the case that mall owners, mall managers know exactly how to keep people interested so they stay shopping, right? As you're walking the mall, you got to have lots of interesting stores and lots of activity and lots of things to keep you interested and kind of moving along. And he said, you know, a lot of downtowns could learn from that. When people walk, they don't want to go very far without something to engage their eye, some kind of storefront that they want to look in, some kind of...
They say like every 5 seconds.
Every 5 seconds. Yeah. Like that, the mall does that. Why can't downtowns do that? And counter to that, there's all sorts of city planners that put parking garages that will be like a full block of just dead wall or looking at cars parked, or even really famous architects will design really iconic looking buildings with no thought to sometimes what meets the street. In a lot of cases, these really cool looking buildings that look great on postcards look terrible from the sidewalk. You see is this long blank wall, and it's pretty oppressive. And so Speck says, if you want to attract walkers, you want to have places that people enjoy walking, you got to keep it visually interesting at a very, you know, frequent pace.
Yeah. I always say active edges make active interiors. Oh, and nice. So again, having that life on the edge really draws people into the space more. And so you have to make sure you have enough activity going on those edges as people are walking.
And not just visual stuff, although visual stuff can get you most of the way, but he talks about thresholds too, like doors and windows that are open and, you know, restaurants that have a table spilling out into the sidewalk and all those kinds of things that really allow us not only to see, but to actually engage and hear, and more of our senses get involved when we walk along. So
yeah,
I love that interesting walk.
Definitely. So is there ways that our listeners can take some of these ideas back to their own neighborhoods and assess walkability surrounding their church or their home?
Absolutely. I think it's one of those paradigm shift things where I think if you read this book or you pay attention to these concepts, you'll start to see things differently. You'll notice, I certainly do. When I go anywhere, I'm constantly assessing its walkability and trying to make sense of what's working and what isn't working. But I think pastors, especially, or church leaders, one thing that you could do that'd be kind of interesting is just first figure out what the walk score is of where you're at. Now, walk score, we've talked about this before, at least I've written about this, that it's not a perfect measure. It mostly measures things like mixed use, but it's not a bad place to start. But if your zip code has a high walk score, then you're probably in a somewhat walkable neighborhood. And a lot of church leaders aren't even aware of that as an asset.
Yeah.
If they happen to find themselves in a walkable neighborhood and they're thinking totally in terms of driving culture, you know, everything from how they put signage around their church is all based on somebody driving in, and they're missing opportunity to engage with all the pedestrians around them, you know? So having signs at the sidewalk level to point people into things, or having, you know, dog bowls with water in them for the people walking their dogs in the neighborhood. You could probably say more about this than I could, right, Sarah Joy. But
I was just thinking too, like even encouraging people who come to their church services to after service walk somewhere and enjoy lunch in the neighborhood or engage in the neighborhood just on foot. You'll learn so much more about the neighborhood in that process and be a visible presence. So
yeah, absolutely. So that's one thing you can do. If you happen to be in a walkable neighborhood with your church, right away, you can start just appreciating that and leaning into that in terms of your ministry strategies and how you connect with people. The other thing I might say is if you're in a place that maybe isn't as high on the walk score, or isn't as walkable, it's just helpful to know that that's really sort of a growing area of interest for people and for your planners in your district and whatnot. And there's a good chance that there's things in play in your city that are trying to increase the walkability of your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And just getting involved in those conversations and not seeing them as sort of obscure things, right. But really getting involved in those is one of the ways that you can really help build connections with your neighbors and with some of your government officials and other folks to really be thinking about how can you, I mean, I think a church on its own would really have a hard time trying to increase the walkability of their neighborhood. There's just a lot of things they can't do. Mm-hmm. But if things are already in place and things are already getting started, they could certainly contribute to that.
Right.
They could be advocates for it. And that would really benefit their neighborhood and create all sorts of opportunities for making connections with their neighbors.
Right. And I would say that's part of the call of the church to advocate for human dignity, right?
Yeah.
And if we truly believe that we were created to walk and that's what opens the door to so much of us being able to embrace our embodiment and get to know one another and live into that calling that God has given us, then we should be advocates for it.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thanks. This has been great. I think you've done a good job unpacking a lot of Jeff Speck's work. We encourage our listeners to go read it in full because there's much more that we haven't even touched on, but there's a lot of good gems in this. And our next installment is going to be Cities for People by Jan Gehl, right?
Yes, which is a fabulous book.
And I'll get to be unpacking that one for you all.
Yes, so, yes.
Cool.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. I appreciate your insight. I hope our listeners do too.
Yeah, enjoyed the conversation.
Talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to another episode of the Embedded Church podcast. We hope our interviews and book discussions have brought new ideas and encouragement to you over the past few seasons. A huge thank you to all of you who have provided financial support to keep this podcast going. We're still looking for a few $100s to finish out our funding for season 3. If you like what you hear and want to contribute to this work, please consider giving to our Indiegogo campaign. We'll put a link in our show notes and on the website at embeddedchurch.com. Neither Eric or I are compensated for our time. We use these funds simply to cover hosting platform and editing costs. Your generosity will help us keep this going. You can also support this work by encouraging your family and friends to tune in and by rating and reviewing this podcast on iTunes. If you want to stay connected with us, sign up for our mailing list on the embeddedchurch.com website. Thanks for listening.